Hi, I'm David Kaplan, and you're listening to the Sports Talk Live podcast. Enjoy the show. Welcome to Sports Talk Live on NBC Sports Chicago, brought to you by the Chevy Silverado. I'm David Kaplan with David Haw, JJ Stankiewicz, Chris Bleck. All right, gentlemen, let's start with some NBA talk. Chris, you're my NBA go-to guy. I'll start with you. Disney says it will be hosting NBA games in some fashion. Do you believe we're going to actually get basketball back here, and can this plan work?
Yes, absolutely. And I think number one is because of the players. The players want to get back to playing as soon as possible. We knew Disney all along was one of the options because of the infrastructure that they have. So they have the ability to house and to put on games in a safe environment. I think it's a fantastic idea. Clearly, Adam Silver and the players have gotten on the same page with this. And I think we will see basketball sooner than later.
My favorite Hoosier, what do you say?
It's a small world after all. Yes, the NBA goes to Orlando. It makes a lot of sense. There or Vegas made sense. I think it makes more sense for the NBA to consider this sort of basketball sports biosphere than it does other sports, like baseball, for example. Get the season in, crown a champion. It doesn't take that long to get the rest of the regular season in, but whichever direction they go, I think this is the right one because they're being deliberate. There is not as big of a hurry. You don't feel a rush, and I think they're doing it the wise way.
JJ.
Yeah, I read in the story that was on The Athletic that Orange County in Florida, where Orlando is, actually has a pretty low rate of COVID-19 cases. So already it may fit a little better than some other locations. But look, I think the biggest thing here is just the testing aspect of it is going to have to be where it needs to be. I think if players leave that bubble, come back and get tested, I think that seems like what the NBA is gonna do with it. But that seems like the only way you can really restart anything.
Chris, you think we play playoff basketball right away, or we do finish the last 17 games that each team has left?
It sounds like the league wants to get some more regular season games in. I know there's a target number about like 70 or so that the TV partners need for the regular season to cash the checks. So I wouldn't be surprised, not all 17 games that finish a regular season, but if you gave me like 5 to 10 to just get something and then go into the playoffs, I think that's kind of the format they'll be looking for.
David, you think that also is why we have not heard anything from the Bulls about the future of Jim Boylan? They've been making other changes. Arturis, Mark Eversley, today Jeff Tanaka, the trainer, is relieved of duty, but they haven't done anything with the coaching staff yet because we may need them to just finish out the season.
First-class group of people that are running the show here, and I think they're going to give Jim Boylan an opportunity to finish the season that he started. Now, if they were to eliminate the rest of the regular season, as we talked about, and go straight to the playoffs, then you might see some action. But I think, Cap, you've been saying it. Everybody sort of understands that when the Bulls play their next round of meaningful basketball, the beginning of next season, I think it'll be complete and they'll have a new coach as well as a new front office.
All right, let's move on to Last Dance. It's the gift that keeps on giving. You have no live sports. We get 5 weeks, 10 episodes of an awesome documentary that, it just happens to be about the greatest team in Chicago sports history. And then Horace Grant and others, but Horace especially, on our radio show. Chris and I were there yesterday going, oh my goodness, and it's just blown up worldwide. JJ, were you shocked by the sour grapes, the fallout, the bitterness that exists from a lot of Michael's former teammates?
No, I wasn't shocked because it was Michael's documentary, and rightfully so. By the way, Michael Jordan being the best player in basketball history, the fact that he got to kind of present his version of it, that's okay. Also, to the Horace Grant and the people who think, Scottie Pippen was maybe unfairly portrayed. I am a fan of the Bulls. I grew up with those teams. I don't care. Whatever portrayal of Horace Grant or Scottie or any of these guys does not affect how I think about them, how I remember them as players, how much I love them as players. It doesn't matter at all how they were portrayed in that show.
David?
Well, Cap, I loved you in the role of Vince McMahon. I think it fits your personality quite well in trying to stir this stuff up, and it worked. Look, you lit the match, and they just kept on pouring gasoline on top of the fire. And Horace Grant is entitled to all of the rancor that he expressed and all the animosity he may feel. But, and he's right, it was a so-called documentary. It wasn't a documentary as much as it was a 10-hour video tribute to the greatest player ever. That said, he can be as bitter as he wants. He can be, has much of a grudge and carry the chip on his shoulder. He also has 3 championship rings and a place in NBA history because mostly Michael Jordan happened to be a Bull the same time he was a Chicago Bull. So I think there's some balance there. I love it. Hey, we're not talking about anything else of note, so he can be as bitter as he wants to be.
Christopher.
You know, the thing that I keep going back to is it's not like in the documentary they were blindsided. All of these guys were asked about these specific situations, including Horace Grant, who was asked in the documentary, were you the source for Sam Smith and the Jordan rules? He gave an answer on it. And just because other people gave answers to that same question that he didn't like, to then come out and say that Michael's a snitch now, like, come on. I feel like, yeah, it's bitter grapes. And the way that they kind of look at this is like that because, like, okay, maybe you should have answered the question differently when you sat down for the documentary. You knew what was going to be in it. They asked you about it. Scottie Pippen knew what was in the documentary. Did you want them to not include the 94 season? Because they were asked about it. So I think all the people who are speaking out after the fact are clearly just jealous that, David, like you said, this turned into a Michael Jordan documentary and not a documentary about the Chicago Bulls in the 90s.
All right, quick topic. Tommy Glavine says the players will get the blame if baseball doesn't resume for financial reasons. He said, I learned from 94. I tried to educate people. I was naive. We took the brunt of it, and that's the way it's going to go. You guys agree?
I do. I think that the story in the New York Post today shifts the responsibility and the pressure on the players, because if there was, in fact, documented evidence that they had the right to renegotiate, the owners and the players, if they were playing in front of empty stadiums, then I think that does make it on the players to not take the prorated salary, go for the revenue sharing idea and the de facto salary cap. That will eventually shift the onus on the players, especially with everybody saying, wrapping this argument in the flag and saying it's a patriotic duty to go back and play baseball. So right now the players have most of the pressure on them.
JJ and Chris, we're tight on time. Go ahead.
It's totally unfair. You know, players are the ones going out there and risking themselves to exposure of this virus. You know, people aren't going to tune in to watch Tom Ricketts on TV. They're going to tune in to watch Anthony Rizzo. So for players to be blamed for this, to me, that's completely ridiculous.
Well, I mean, look at the way we started this show. The players in the NBA leading the charge. It seems like the players in Major League Baseball have an issue with what's going on. They're going to take the blame if everyone else starts back up.
Yeah, completely agree. All right, we're going to take a quick time out. Chris Mullin, Dream Teamer, Hall of Famer, former Pacer. He's going to join the show next.
Listen up, Bulls Authentic fans. The My Teams app is the perfect app for you. Get your favorite team at your fingertips. Don't miss out on the best Bulls coverage in the city and read in-depth articles. What are you waiting for? Download the My Teams app now.
All right, coming May 28th, the Sports Uncovered podcast tells the behind-the-scenes story of Michael Jordan's I'm Back facts that changed the NBA forever. Subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts. Chris Mullin, Dream Teamer, phenomenal player, Hall of Famer, kind enough to give us some time today. I'm sure your phone has been ringing with this documentary and everything going on. Did you enjoy watching The Last Dance, Chris?
I did. I tuned in. I mean, it helped, obviously, that there's no live sports on. I'm not quite sure in regular times I would have watched it on Mother's Day. I don't know if that would have went over too well in my household. But I actually tuned into all episodes. And overall, I enjoyed them. I mean, I got a different perspective. Obviously, I didn't play with Michael in the intense 82-game schedule through the playoffs into the finals. So I don't have those experiences with Michael. But, you know, there's no question of his determination, his greatness. I watched him ascend basically from high school through college into his NBA career. Our careers mirrored each other. So I had an up-close and personal look, you know, from a distance, and his ascension to stardom. But, you know, you talk to some guys that went through the rigors of an NBA schedule, different perspective than I have.
So when you look at this 10-episode thing, and I interviewed Horace Grant yesterday, and I mean, he took a flamethrower to Michael. Can you understand certain guys being frustrated how they were perceived, especially Scotty, who we're hearing was not happy with how he was characterized during this documentary?
Yeah, I think it's you have to look at both sides, right? All different sides. Everyone has different angles. And when you're telling stories 20, 25 years later, everyone has their perception of what actually happened. No one has the exact memory to that. So yeah, I can understand that. Again, so my perspective, playing in the Olympic crew with Michael, mostly in all-star game situations, and looking back, I think the games I played with him, we went 24-0. So there's really not much to fret about, right? Saw Michael more in practice situations than game situations. And I think in the documentary was very clear. He had incredible intensity in practice. He was a detail-oriented guy. So his practice mirrored the way he played in the game. He used that as rehearsal, as a preparation. But yeah, different as a teammate in more intense situations. So I could understand it. I don't like it that, you know, the people are getting their feathers ruffled 20 years later. You like to think, well, this guy's 50, 60 years old. You can kind of let it, you know, off your back. But I do understand. Look, this is their legacy. They went through a lot of things together, and probably someone wished they had at least some input on their own, right, to give their side of the story.
So when you think back to the 98 conference finals, and I believed that it ended at the right time. I don't blame management. I thought Dennis was done. Scotty was going to go get paid somewhere, and he had some back injuries going. Like, I understand why it ended. I also thought that you guys very easily could have been not a one-time champ, a multi-time champ. That was a hell of an Indiana team. What do you remember about that series?
Yeah, so obviously we were the one team that pushed them to Game 7. And in that Game 7, on the road, it was a close game. They had to really fight and claw to get that win. So we were right there. Give them credit. They made the big plays. Like they had all their series were close. You know, they had some close calls in the finals. That's where the greatness comes in. That's why Michael is Michael. He's 6-0 in the finals, 6 MVP finals. Six finals MVPs. Yeah, but, you know, the one thing about those Bulls teams, you know, the championship teams was, if you look at, they held Utah to 54 points. You know, they held a really good offensive West Coast Seattle team, a dynamic offensive team. They put them in check defensively. So when they won games, they won in the 80s, which is kind of rare for a really offensive gifted team. But Michael and Scotty at that point in time, they were the two best perimeter defenders in the league. I don't even think it was close. And so they could – and most teams, the perimeter is what makes offenses go. So against us, Scotty got into Mark Jackson and disrupted our offense. Michael, Ron Harper got into me and Reggie, and they could chase off screens and really just shut your offense down. So for the ability for them to win with, you know, a beautiful triangle free-flowing offense – on a given night, or, you know, just lock a team down defensively is what really, so they could play both ways, they can win both ways.
We had Kathy Martin Harrison on yesterday. You may not know that name. She was the blonde-haired Pacers fan that's swearing at the Bulls players in the documentary. And we located her and had her on yesterday. And she said, I hated the Chicago Bulls. She's been a season ticket holder of the Indiana Pacers for 44 years. She still is. And she said, I went at it with Patrick Ewing, Michael Jordan, Dennis Rodman. She goes, but they cut our heart out because we had a really good team. Did you feel that way looking back? Like, man, if that team isn't around, we're champions.
Yeah, that happened to a lot of teams, right? In Indiana, so I played 13 years in Golden State, 3 in Indiana. Very unique place, very close to Chicago, but very different atmosphere, yep. More of a college atmosphere. You know, yep. When you go into games, they're driving down to Market Square, now the new field house, with flags hanging out. I never saw that for a pro team. So it was an incredible fan base. obviously with Larry coaching, you know, he's missed Indiana. Donnie Walsh had been there. The Simons are a great ownership group. So there's a really incredible feel for that organization there, rightfully so. What I liked about that clip, though, was when my boy Joe Klein just looked over like, what? So on that team, you know, Michael, of course, gets to dominate, you know, the headlines. But Bill Weddington was my roommate in college. Joe Klein, we played on the 84 Olympic team together. Obviously, I knew Steve Kerr, Judd Bushler I had played with. So these are guys I kind of grew up with through high school, college, and the pros. So I don't think there was great admiration and respect, no question. But from an intimidation standpoint, we weren't intimidated. We knew they were great, but we were trying to beat them. And we came very close. A few, you know, jump ball here or there. You know, a few made a few defensive rebounds. It could be different. But you look at Jerry West only got one championship, right? There's right. a reason why. There's a reason why. Bill Russell. So all the players during Michael's era, they didn't, six were his. So there's a damn good reason a lot of us don't have rings. And when you see this documentary, you go, oh, that makes sense.
Yeah, I get it. So when you were at Golden State, Michael shows up to practice with you guys. What do you remember about that? And at that moment, did he say to you, I'm coming back?
No, he didn't say it, but his play said it. So he was really good friends with Rod Higgins, who was one of my best friends. Uh-huh. And Rod started in Chicago when Mike was a rookie. I think Rod was in his second year when Mike was a rookie. They were really good friends. Mike would pop out to the Bay Area periodically to go to Napa, play some golf. It was in season, and I think he was up in Napa. He popped down to one of our practices. And we're sitting, and I was injured at the time, so I was sitting on a scorer's table watching. It was Tim Hardaway, Latrell Sprewell. We had a good, young, talented group. And they might have been popping off a little bit, which makes sense. That's all it takes for Michael to get going. And he's like, Mo, come on, give me your stuff. Because we wore the same size sneakers. And so I went in my locker, got in my gear. And he said, Nelly, let's get a 5-on-5 going. Let's get a scrimmage. Nelly said, yeah, sure. And Mike went out there. And these guys were, you know, obviously in season. Michael had been playing. And he dominated the scrimmage. His team won. He was posting up Tim, killing Sprewell. And just that, so he didn't say anything, but when I watched him play, like just show up and do that, that this guy has to come back. He's in great shape. He's sharp as ever. It's so in the back of my mind, I'm like, he's coming back. He's got to. I mean, this is ridiculous how good he is still. Yes, that was moments like that is what makes me, from my standpoint, from my point of view, really always look at Michael the same way I did in 1981 when he came out. He came out to the Bay Area after the 93 season. He had gone through the grueling championship season. He had lost his dad. And I remember him being out here just physically and emotionally fatigued, like falling asleep on my couch, just kind of relaxing. And we went and played some golf. We went and played some tennis with Brad Gilbert and just really getting away from everything, just coming to see his buddy Rod. And just we just did stuff that we would have done in 1981 when I met him as a high school guy. So from my perspective, I get the intensity and the grueling practice session he had with those teammates. But I saw him, like I said, in all winning situations and in small doses.
We're just about out of time, but really quick, I got to ask you, what was it like the practice, the game you guys had in the Olympics? Because the late Chuck Daly said to me, the greatest game I ever saw, and there was not one fan in there.
Yeah, that makes it incredible. And the legendary players, and we all knew who they are, but it came down to Michael and Magic, really a one-on-one duel. Everyone else just kind of played the bit role. You know, I always say it'd be like being in a great mob movie with De Niro and Pacino.
Yep.
Just don't mess up your role. But Michael basically took the torch from Michael in that practice session on our way to Barcelona, and Magic handed it over, not graciously, but he said, you know, you're the greatest. Lead us to the gold medal. But I think what is underrated, and you mentioned, I'm glad you mentioned that, is the Chuck Daly influence on that whole summer. The incredible wisdom and humility that he had within his greatness, knowing what buttons to push. And I think he just felt like we need a little sharper edge before we went to the Olympics. And he knew the Michael Magic dynamic would bring that out. Yeah, so all those great legendary players playing in an empty gym in Monte Carlo, and you got Magic and Michael just going at it verbally, physically. You got Charles Barkley versus Karl Malone, Patrick Ewing versus David Robinson, you know, just up and down. It's just an incredible thing to look back on. So that's the one thing with the Last Dance or the Dream Team. I always, at this point in my life, really just cherish those memories. And I kind of gear toward the good times, you know. And like I said, it's more from a different perspective than, say, Michael's teammates with the Bulls.
Appreciate your time. Loved watching you play. You're a good man. Best of luck. Stay safe and healthy.
Same to you. Thank you.
Got it. More Sports Talk Live right after this.
White Sox authentic fans, if you don't have the My Teams app yet, what are you waiting for? Stay up to date with the best Sox coverage in the city and read articles from White Sox insiders. Bring the South Side to your home and download the My Teams app now.
All right, welcome back on Sports Talk Live, brought to you by the Chevy Silverado. Quick reminder, their service centers and their technicians available. ChevyDriveChicago.com to find a location near you. I'm going to ask the three of you. You're all sports fans. We all got in this because we love sports. Name me an athlete on the anniversary of Michael Barrett punching AJ in the face, and I was there as a fan that day. Name me an athlete, Chris, you hated in your life.
You know, going to Bears games my entire life, it was Brett Favre. He was always there to have a great pass, to win a game against the Chicago Bears. And the Bears, for the majority of his career, were not very good. It's Brett Favre in my book.
David.
Well, besides every wide receiver for the Mid-American Conference opponent every Saturday during college, I hated those guys every week. Had to be the guy that popped into my head, the face that you just wanted to punch, Bill Laimbeer, the most punchable face in all of sports throughout the 80s and 90s.
Wow, you took one of mine. JJ.
Pick a Piranha and the Minnesota Twins in the mid-2000s. Nick Punto, Lou Ford, all those guys who just dinked and ducked the heck out of the White Sox in all those games. Those guys I hated as growing up.
Morneau. Yeah.
No, Morneau was too good. I'm talking about, like, the guys who were bad except when they faced the White Sox.
Yeah, I've got to go with Chris and David. I saw Bill Laimbeer be a complete jackass to a little kid, and I always hated him as a Piston, so that doubled down. So he'd be number one, but Brett Favre right behind him.
How do you hate Favre? He was maybe the top 10 quarterback in NFL history.
Doesn't matter. He was a dirty Packer.
You respect him, but he killed the Bears. Come on.
All right. Okay. Jay Cutler's third on the list. You guys have a wonderful rest of your day. Stay safe and healthy. We'll see you tomorrow on Sports Talk Live. Have a great night.